Okay, thanks very much. And it's very nice to see Primita sort of growing so much. It's not just it's very nice because it's not just the banks and insurance companies that grow like that. There's these fundamental institutes that that grow. It's great. It's great to see that. So I'm going to be talking about anomalous dipole and testing the cosmological principle. It's a bit probably different from the seminars you have here. I don't know what they are, but I'm going to show you very few words and even fewer equations. So I hope you're not too disappointed at the end of this talk. And so what is the cosmological principle? So if at some point you get bored, you just tell me that, no, I can just go very fast. So cosmological principle is basically an hypothesis. It's a hypothesis that the universe is homogeneous and isotropic. And for the theorists among you, I think most of you are, is that basically the theory or the model that we write is invariant under translation and rotation. That's what we expect. And so a metric that satisfies that is, as you all know, is Friedmann-Lemaître-Robertson-Walker FLRW metric. You see that it satisfies the homogeneity and isotropy. Now, the universe doesn't have to be both homogeneous and isotropic. For example, the universe can be homogeneous, but not isotropic and isotropic. Such universes usually have a preferred axis. And the metric that, for example, that represents such universe is a Bianchi metric that I'm sure you're all familiar with. Now, it could be reverse, that is, the universe doesn't have to be homogeneous. It could be inhomogeneous and isotropic. And in that case, very often the universe would have a center, a preferred observer. An example of such universe is the Lemaître-Tolman-Bondi universe. You can write the metric for it. And then the last possibility is that the universe is really very complicated, is neither homogeneous nor isotropic. And then you have this horrendous huge metric to describe this universe. An example of such universe is Zekeres models. Now you see immediately from this presentation why we like FLRW metric, why we like homogeneous and isotropic metric. It's just because it makes life so much simpler. Life is so much sweeter when you work with this metric than if you have to work with such a metric. And in fact, when I'm going to give you just a little bit of history, when Einstein wrote his equation of GR, so he was actually looking for a solution to his equation, highly nonlinear equation. And the first solution he came up with was the Einstein universe. It's a homogeneous universe. And because he didn't want expansion, he didn't believe in expanding universe, he believed really very strongly in a static universe, he put the cosmological constant in there. Then people came like Eddington and showed that actually Einstein universe is not stable. And so De Sitter came along more or less same time, and he wrote a universe without matter and just with cosmological constant. And that is what you all know as the De Sitter universe. So these are all just people trying to solve Einstein equation. And then a bit later on, we had these visionary peoples, really Friedman and Lemaître, they were visionary. And they said, well, let's look at the universe that is expanding. Now, this is before Hubble actually discovered observationally the expansion of the universe. So they were really the ones, actually, the theorists, visionary theorists. And they said it's actually expanding. And so they wrote the metric for expanding universe. Einstein was really against it, actually. And he actually said, well, it cannot be. The universe has to be static and so on. And then Robertson and Walker were just mathematicians. And you know, as most mathematicians, they were looking for a general solution and unique solution to Einstein equation. They weren't really even physicists. So all of these people were trying to solve Einstein equation. Then the history continues. And then later on, after the discovery of Hubble, Einstein now retracted, and now he believed in the expanding universe. And so he wrote a metric for a universe together with De Sitter, the Einstein De Sitter metric, in which you have got matter, you don't have any cosmological constant. And nowadays we know that the FLRW metric at very early times becomes Einstein De Sitter metric, and at very late times becomes represented De Sitter universe. So all of these people were really just trying to solve Einstein equation. They didn't have any a priori vision for the universe. Until came Milne, who was a professor of mathematics at Oxford. And he actually had a very different view of doing science. So he didn't believe in the writings that he wrote that, you know, we write our theories to describe our universe. But he said, well, I'm going to do inverse. I'm going to write a model which would explain or describe my belief. So it's a little bit religious. And he said, okay, I believe in a universe that is homogeneous and isotropic. The universe is like that. He didn't much believe much in GR. He believed in Hughes Newtonian gravity together with a special relativity, and he wrote Milne's model. Now, best account of Milne's universe is given by Paul Dirac. And here it really explains what the cosmological principle is. So this is Paul Dirac writing in 1937. And he says, you see, we now feel the need for some new assumption on which to build up a theory of cosmology. This need is partially satisfied by the assumption which Milne calls the cosmological principle, that apart from local irregularities, the universe is everywhere uniform and has a spherical symmetry. And then later on in that same paper, he writes, these assumptions are fairly plausible and have a great simplifying effect on the subject. And until there is more definite evidence of their inadequacy, it doesn't seem worthwhile to try more complicated schemes. So basically, he's saying very clearly that this is nice because this is simple and, you know, I can't do anything better for now, so let's do this. But we are not in SETIs anymore. And nowadays, we have very sophisticated observations. We throw satellites into space. We have huge telescopes. We can go and make observations. We can do experiments, very sophisticated stuff we do. And so we don't have to believe in these things, right? We can go and see whether it's correct or not. We can make observations. We can make experiments, if you like. So what is the observational evidence for cosmological principle, apart from a belief? Well, just before telling you about that, I want to mention Karl Popper, who was still is a very influential philosopher. And Karl Popper was very strongly against cosmological principle. He would actually write and say that the cosmological principle were, I fear, dogmas that should not have been proposed, because he believed on refutability of a theory, on falsifiability. And he saw that cosmological principle didn't have any of these things, so I don't care about it. So again, you see, we believe in that. We don't really need Karl Popper to come and tell us that. We think that, you know, theory should be falsifiable. And so now we can use observations to basically verify the cosmological principle. And what is the strongest evidence for cosmological principle? What evidence do we have that the universe is homogeneous and isotropic? And the strongest evidence, perhaps, is the fluctuations, is the cosmic microwave background radiation, which is extremely isotropic. There's just little fluctuations that are 10 to the minus 5. Otherwise, the temperature is the same no matter which direction you look at. And this is strong evidence for the isotropy of the universe. But behind this map that you've all seen millions of times, I think, before this map was obtained of our universe, there is a fluctuation behind this map is hidden that is 100 times larger than this. And that is the CMB dipole. So the primordial fluctuations are order of 10 to the minus 5. CMB fluctuation is of the order of 10 to the minus 3. Now, primordial, both of them in some sense are attributed to a Doppler effect. Primordial fluctuations because the photons are climbing up and down the gravitational potential. But here, the Doppler effect is due to the motion of the observer. It's basically due to our motion. So we are going towards a certain direction. The light coming is blue shifted, and behind us is red shifted. It's just a simple Doppler effect. That is what we think it is, because what we are measuring is temperature and isotropy. But then we attribute it fully to a Doppler effect. It's quite plausible. And another way of saying it is that the CMB dipole has a purely kinematic origin. Now, this was actually done very early at the times of CMB, a few years just after Penzias and Wilson, they discovered the CMB. So there was a paper, written theoretical paper, that, you know, what is the velocity of an observer, V is the velocity of an observer that is moving in a black body radiation that would give the temperature anisotropy to the left that I see in the CMB. So you see, the temperature anisotropy is related to the velocity of an observer, and you see very clearly that there is a dipole because there is a cosine there. Now, before even Peebles and Wilkinson, they talked about this, there was someone else who talked about it, because the question arises, if the universe is isotropic, why should the observer have a motion? Why should any observer have a motion? Because if the universe is isotropic, you shouldn't be going anywhere. But then, almost for a long time, almost everyone agrees that the local universe is anisotropic. On very large scales, when you go, it should become isotropic. And so if you look at the universe around us, you see that here we are sitting right at the center, and there is a flow. This is the velocity field around us, and there is a flow that is towards this huge structure, Virgo supercluster, near us. And if I go a little bit further away, I see, again, there is a flow into this great attractor, which is the two superclusters of Hydra and Centaurus. And you see, not only from the velocity map, but also from the distribution, this is also shows the density field, that you see some parts of the universe are quite void, and some other parts, there is more matter. So it's not isotropic. And actually, the very first person to talk about this, that, you know, actually predict the CMB dipole, this is before the discovery of CMB dipole, he actually predicted it before Peebles and Wilkinson, was Dennis Sharma and Stewart in 1967 paper, Nature paper. And it's amazing, because they are actually saying, okay, CMB has been discovered by Penzias and Wilson about a few years before that, 1964, I think, and this is 67, so 2 years afterwards. And they're saying, okay, but at that time they didn't see the dipole. But he's saying, okay, if we were at rest, then we wouldn't see any dipole. But we are not at rest, because there is Virgo, and Virgo is pulling us. And so we are an observer in motion, and then we should see a dipole in the CMB. So they actually predicted it. The velocity they predicted was not very accurate, because the data was not really very good at that time. And they were using completely kinematic data. And then you see, then other people came, and the data sort of, the number of data points increased. And then you see, this was this other paper, for example, that I'm showing you, that Taman and Sandesh, they wrote that, well, you see, the Virgo cannot account for our full motion. We need to have something else. And then you see, at that time, they were saying that, well, Hydra and Centaurus that I showed you, the great attractor, you see, Taman and Sandesh also suggested the gravity of the Hydra and Centaurus as the cause of the local group's motion, because there has to be something that is pulling us in a certain direction. And at the beginning, Dennis Sharma thought it was Virgo. Then you see, the calculations became more sophisticated. Then they said, okay, no, we have to go further away. Hydra and Centaurus, for a long time, people believed that was the reason for our motion. And then they came, you see, Lindenberg came and said, well, you see, even Hydra and Centaurus could not account for it. There's something not quite right. This is his wording in his paper. And then you see, there was this paper that became very famous, The Seven Samurai.
Question.
Yeah.
Why is it called presidential address?
Yeah, I think it was something that they would do it every year. Yeah.
The president of Record
Astronomical. I thought so, yeah. Yeah, I hope so. I hope it was not some sort of a president who wouldn't know anything about these things. Yeah.
Am I understanding this? You're saying they were measuring dipoles to be bigger than what the bulk flow they expected from just this Virgo pulling. Is that
the... Yeah, so they measured the CMB dipole, and then you see they used this formula of Peebles and Wilkinson, And from this formula of Peebles and Wilkinson, you see here you don't need any data. You just measure the temperature and isotropy. And you say, OK, our velocity has to be about 400 kilometers per second. And then these other people said, OK, but where does this 400 kilometers per second could come from? So it has to be the pool of these, you know, bigger structures that are on one side and not in the other side that are taking us in that direction. Another question was, which structure would account for this? So at the beginning, Sharma thought, well, this is Virgo, which is near us. And he said, OK, let's calculate the pool of Virgo. And then he said, well, it's more or less, you know, this. Then people came with better data and said, well, this cannot account for all of our motion, because that accounts only for 300 kilometers per second. And then they said, OK, we have to go a little bit further away. And you see, this was what I was showing here. So you see, at the beginning, they thought just Virgo was enough, because the universe was small at that time. See, we didn't know what happened before, after that.
Taking into account dark matter?
Yes, that's definitely after Zwicky and so on. Yeah, they used kinematic data, but you know they had luminosity, so they had to do some mass modeling and things. Yeah. Otherwise they couldn't. So this is, And then they said, okay, well, I have, so you know the mass, for example, that they put here is taking into account dark matter, it's 10 to the power of 15, 16, it's more than luminous. And then they said, okay, this is here. You see, this is because this is huge also. So, well, this is pulling us a little bit, about 300 kilometers per second. This is another 300, so that's fine. Then, you know, the data became better and better. And because, as you can imagine, there's a lot of modeling in this, right? How much dark matter you put and whether I have the radial velocities or not and so on. And then they came and said, oh, no, this became, for a long time, actually, people thought it was the great attractor, Hydrogen Centaurus. But then you see there was this paper by seven, became known as the seven samurai that just, made the whole palace collapse because people were believing that great attractor, you see, what they called great attractor was responsible for the CMB dipole. And they came and said, well, no, it's not, because we have to go further away, actually. There's something else. Well, it's like children, you know, always want to go and see what is beyond. So what can we do, actually, now? Because you see, you've seen so far, it's not very clear. Now, what I'm going to show you now is just a very smoothly going to take you through the work that I've been doing in the past 15 years. So how can we answer that? What is the origin of the CMB dipole, really? If it's not fully Virgo great attractor after that, where it is coming from? So we can look at data. And the data that would respond to such questions in astronomy, you can divide them into three kinds. Basically, there are sets of data which give you almost every information you need about the source that you observe. That is, they give you the angular position of the source on your sky. They give you the radial position, but not only just the redshift, which is more or less radial position, but also the real distance to that source. These data are fantastic. They're very complete. An example of this data are the supernovae, for example. But there are not very many of them, because first of all, it's very, very hard to measure distances. And second, it's less hard, but it's still hard to go and measure redshifts. So the second group of data that I'm going to be talking about and using to respond to this question of CMB dipole is the data that does not have a measure of distances. We have many more of those, but they are less informative. And then the third type of data are fantastic. We have got just images of these sources in the sky. We have got their angular position, but then we don't know where they are, you see. So we have to do something with these data. We have no other choice. So let's look at the first type of data, the supernovae. They are standard candles, for example. And they give us the angular position and the distance to these sources. And then, you see, what we are going to do, we are going to look at volume, larger and larger volume around us. And we are going to see whether we converge at some point to the CMB rest frame, because that's more or less another way of putting the question. Where is the CMB rest frame? And so you see, when I look at this first chunk of matter around me, I have, coming back again to Virgo, and this other side, I've got a smaller one, a little further away, Fornax cluster. And so, see, we can see where we are going. Now, I have got every information about these sources, and so I can figure out what the velocity of this volume is. And then I go a little bit further away. This is what great attractor I showed you. And then these other smaller, less significant objects that are, however, important, I add them. And then we are going to do this. It's just simple exercise, going far and far away. And then at the same time, every time we make the volume bigger, we are going to see where this volume is going. And if we have reached the CMB rest frame, then this volume should be going nowhere, because it is at rest with respect to CMB rest frame. Yeah.
So what is the actual theta here that you'll be using? Is it the luminosity and the dipole and then the luminosity?
Yeah, we are not really using luminosity. We are only using the positions.
Number counts.
Yeah, and no, because we have the velocities actually here. Yeah. It's fantastic, yeah. Because you see, this is very powerful. Because from distance and redshift, you can get the velocities.
So you get like a relative velocity.
Exactly. So what exactly what I'm doing here, well, a very simple way of looking at it, is that in this volume, now I've shown you the big object, but what I have, the velocity of all these point sources, right? And I can just average them. And if the average velocity is zero, that means this volume is at rest. And if the average is not zero, that means it has a motion. But with respect to what? With respect to the CMB rest frame, because that is how the redshifts are measured. Yes? Does that answer your question? Yes.
Just to make sure that I understand. So the idea is to take larger and larger volumes and construct like a velocity map until we find that that patch on average is a zero average velocity, so that we say that now we reached at like the CMB frame. And then we can compare this patch to whatever we get from the CMB and see if they agree or something.
From the lambda, from the model that assumes homogeneity and isotropy. Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes, that's right. Now, just to tell you, we don't construct the velocities here. They observe them basically. So then you see, then I come to the case where we have to construct the velocities because we can't measure. But here for this data, there are not very many points, about a few hundred, you know, 1,000 points, not very many. But then we have got fantastic information about them. We know where they are exactly, and we know at what velocity they are moving, radial velocity.
You probably turn them into a field somehow.
Yeah, exactly. You turn them into a velocity field. You know, you can average and so on. You can do a lot of sophisticated things and do a smoothing and so on. Yeah, sure. And so you see, this is basic, and the error bars are big because you see, we don't have very many sources. So this is basically the best fit to the velocity of that volume. And then I'm going to do this going on and on. So then I see I go further away, I add bigger patch, and I measure the average velocity. See, this is the best fit. These are the 1 and 2 sigma lines. Huge error bars. And then I go further away. Now the direction of this motion, see, the motion is not zero, it's got a motion. The direction is very similar to the direction of the CMB dipole, but the amplitude. And then you see, this is basically as far as I could go with sort of data. And now if I push it a little bit more, I can go slightly further, but more or less I stop at Shapley, which is a huge supercluster at about 150 megaparsec from us. Yes. I might follow me. And so you see, it's not conclusive, right? I am here, it's not going down. But what is the model telling me? So this is a lambda CDM prediction, see? And depends on your taste. You can say it disagrees with lambda CDM at 1 or 2 sigma, or you can say it agrees with lambda CDM at 1 or 2 sigma, whichever way you like to look at it. It's not very satisfactory. So we need to really establish this. We need more data. But I can't have more data without losing information, because it's not easy to find distances. So I just have to somehow forget about distances. Yes?
So the lambda CDM prediction is the linear prediction of the bulk velocity. It is a
exactly, yeah. This is linear theory. Yeah, but at this, you see, nonlinear effects are probably important here. Yeah.
Because you average them.
Yeah, exactly. So you see, already at the scale of Virgo, you're at about 20, at volume at 20 megaparsec. So yeah, you're right. But you can do a nonlinear power spectrum from lambda CDM. At this scale, it's not going to make much difference. So now we want to increase the number of data points, but then I have to give up on certain informations. And so you see, this is going to make life, for the time being, even now today's, We only have the distance measurements for about a few thousands of sources. We have redshifts measured for a few millions. So if I didn't need to use distances, I could have a lot more data points. So I could maybe establish, you know, better the answer to the isotropy universe, whether the universe is isotropic or not. Maybe I can have a more statistically significant result if I could do something without distances, just with the angular position and the redshift. Now, at this point, you have to do some modeling, you see, because what you really need with such an approach is that you need velocities, and somehow you have to find out the velocities. And modeling is not very difficult, because then you can model the universe as a fluid. You write the fluid equations, and then you can use linear theory. And from the density field that you have, you can find the velocity field. Now, we developed our own method, which is based on optimal transport, which I'll be talking about later on this week. And that basically allows you to find the velocities given the positions. So there is a modeling here. It's not as independent and model independent as that. But then I have millions of data instead of a few thousand. And so this is what we did. So we applied this to a redshift data, and we found the velocity field. And this is the velocity field, for example, that we reconstructed. And again, I'm showing you, it's more or less the same as what you saw for the supernovae. We are sitting right at the center. See, we are going towards Virgo. Further away, we are going towards Great Attractor. You go further away to the edge of this data set, which is a catalog. And we have got this Shapley. So you know there is a fall into Shapley. So I have a lot more data points. And this is the perhaps a better plot than the other one, because I can also put CMB dipole here. So you see, this is the CMB dipole, basically the velocity, our velocity with respect to the CMB rest frame. This is what we want to achieve. This is what the model is saying, the model based on FLRW metric is saying. It's saying that at such a scale, you have already achieved the CMB dipole. And this is what the data is saying. You see, the data, which I sort of somehow use the model to get the velocity from. But data.
And which data is this one? Again, is this supernova?
No, this is the 2MRS data. So with supernova data, I had about 1,000 points. Here I have got 25,000. And this is basically the data that gives you angular position and the redshifts.
Which objects are these?
These are just the galaxies in the K-band. Yeah, galaxies.
Do you need, so for your method, do you need a precise luminosity measurement?
Yes. No, but precise, no, but I need luminosity measurements so that I would give the mass. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yes, exactly.
Then are these spots limited surveys?
Yes.
So if you go to high redshift, then I will naively expect that your luminosity measurement is just worse. You're getting less potency.
Of course, yeah. But then you see there is this completeness issues and so on that you have to deal with. Yes, of course. The galaxy, the catalog is not going to be complete. Yes. With all flux limited catalogs, we have that.
Right, and you're very sensitive.
But then you are. We are not very sensitive. I mean, it depends on to what accuracy we want to find this. But you see, we want to find the convergence. So, of course, if you completely change the flux of an object, yeah, that would change. But, yeah.
But then I wonder, like, can these points move around, like these points that you show in the next plot?
Yes.
You're reconstructing velocity.
Yes.
More around if you had like some luminosity misreconstruction or something.
These are huge objects that are basically determining the gravitational field.
Okay.
And so for them, you see that the arrow in the luminosity is not going to be that huge. But of course, when you want to zoom into to see what's happening, then that question becomes very important. Yes. But, and also we are basically, the easiest way is to model it using linear theory for the fluid equations, basically Newtonian fluid equations. If you use linear theory in the Lagrangian regime, which is more or less what we are doing, then you are probing into semi-nonlinear regime. But then fully nonlinear regime is not included in these modeling. It's quite difficult to do this.
Mm-hmm. So I didn't quite follow that answer. So just to go back to that plot, like is the procedure that you're doing, you know, that you measure the density spatially and then use a bias model then to predict what the velocities are? Is that what you're doing?
So what I am doing, now that you're very interested, I wanted to not tell you about that because that's what really interests me. I might just talk about that. So what we are doing actually is we are solving this equation. Now you might say, what is this equation? This is basic equation of the conservation of mass. So you have got this catalog, which is what I showed you, the 2MRS catalog, right? And you are saying that when I go far back in time, the universe was homogeneous. Basically, at the time of CMB, the velocities were vanishing, right? The fluctuations were very small. So this gives me two boundary conditions. And if I say that the mass is conserved, then I have got a highly nonlinear equation, right? Which has got density on the right-hand side. And this highly nonlinear equation is conservation of mass. These two boundary conditions are solving. So this is exactly what I do. But of course, in this equation, you see that there is density field. There's input density field, because this is all the modelings are based on a fluid model for dark matter, right? Because at the end of the day, you are finding velocity. So the velocity is determining or being determined by the mass. So you need to give them mass. And so there is a mass to light ratio that you put there. On those scales, we put a bias of 1. But of course, you could change the bias and so on. So what I'm saying is, of course, this is very important question. Whether the answer depends a lot on your mass to light ratio, your bias, and so on. But because we are looking at universe on larger scales, and because there are few, so this is another way of looking at this. It's a bit, it's a beautiful mathematical way of getting these velocities. It's basically a Lagrangian perturbation theory that we solve, but I can say in a more elegant way. And so, what I was trying to say is that, of course, this is important, what is your mass to light ratio, and whether you have good measurement of luminosities or not. But because it's the velocity field really on those scales being determined by these huge superclusters, and so you see, if you have got a good measurement of their luminosity, then it's fine. But of course, it all depends on how much mass there is and so on. So people, you know, like people have tried to, like, respond to this question using MOND, modified Newtonian gravity, without dark matter and so on. So, of course.
What's the difference between these two plots, this one and the previous one?
It seems to agree a little.
Oh, I put the one sigma of the lambda CDM. So this is the one sigma of lambda CDM, you see these two dashed lines. This is the lambda CDM, and this is one sigma line, using assuming Maxwellian distribution of the velocities in lambda CDM.
But the previous one that was very far off, and now it's
this one?
Yeah.
It's the same. I think it's probably a different scale. Okay. Yeah. It does look far off, that's true, but I think it's just different because I'm sort of, you know, it's being squashed.
So it's that one sigma from the lambda CDM?
Yes.
What is the error on the lambda CDM?
So from one sigma line, you say that the distribution of velocities is Maxwellian. And then using Maxwellian distribution, you calculate using the basic power spectrum of lambda CDM. So you've got power spectrum lambda CDM. Then you have a power spectrum for the density field. You can get the power spectrum for the velocity field. So that gives you the best fit line. And then to get these two lines, you use a Maxwellian distribution. So that gives you the sigma. Yes.
Okay. Variance.
Yeah, variance, exactly. It does give you the variance.
Change CDM to, for example, like more of a dark matter. Those are these.
Yeah.
Data points under red.
Of course, that would change, yeah, because dark matter, well, I have to be careful about that, because warm dark matter on these scales is more or less the same as cold dark matter, right? It's on smaller scales that it doesn't do clustering. So I don't know if anyone has done that. I don't think anyone has done that for these bulk flows, but I wouldn't expect it to make a difference at these scales. Although, definitely at the smaller scales, that's for sure if it makes it, because it would wash out the. Because it doesn't cluster as much as the.
So the issue is the lambda CDM predicts larger bulk flow than the observation.
Yeah, so this is, again, the same thing, you see. You would say, it's not bad, right? Lambda CDM, data lambda CDM is okay. And I've reached, I've converged to the CMB dot. But then you might say, well, I'm not very happy with this. So I want it better, you know. Why is it that, you know, here, it's coming down, and here, of course, the data is really not very good, again, because of those issues like measurement of flux, things, and you know, you reach the edge of the what you see is flux limited and so on. But you know, it's not bad, I would say. I mean, lambda CDM is doing quite well. But then this was a subject of a lot of debates. Now, some people even contradicted themselves. So they wrote a paper saying, this is in disagreement, 3 sigma with lambda CDM, not this one, but they had their own plots. And then a few days later, they said, no, this is in agreement. And it's, I mean, this is like being haunted by, this field is really haunted because it's not been going away. This has been a subject of dispute since maybe when Dennis Sharma wrote his papers, actually. And then, you know, the paper of Seven Samurai already, you know, is saying, no, these people are not right. And then, so there's another part of the history that, you know, later on, then there was Lauren Postman who came and said, oh, no, you see, even if you go to about 150 megaparsec here, this is going to continue. And then some people said no. So it's a lot of debate. And I
So on this plot, you said that the points use a bias of one.
Yes.
And so if you vary the bias, how does this move?
So if you vary the bias, so if you have got more mass, then I suppose this would move up, right? On average, I would expect to see, you have to do this, but I would expect to see higher velocities of the local group because you have got more massive objects nearby. So you can, I expect this to depend. I mean, if you have got a scale-dependent bias, then it's going to be a mess. I don't know how to do it, but I mean, I can't just say it off the top of my head like that. But if it's, you have got a linear bias and you move it, I would expect these data points to go phase up. So you would reach it here faster, I would expect. You know, you would converge to CMB dipole faster. I would expect that. Mm. Does that make sense?
Yeah, maybe. I have a hard time, I guess. Yeah.
Yes.
What to do on this plot.
Yes.
It is like maybe a modified version of the continuity equation that one
saw. Exactly, yeah. Yes.
More mass to the velocity.
Exactly, yeah.
Relationship is.
Exactly. I mean, exactly what you're doing continuity equation. You see, if I've got, so if I can just, now that you've got beautiful blackboards, I've got initially, so I've got sort of a mass element here, right? And you say, okay, initially I've got rho of, let's call my coordinates dq. And then you say, now I have got a mass concentration. I mean, this is basically a mass concentration. I'm just showing an element of mass. And then here I've got another concentration, which is not so uniform. And I've got my element of mass here, let's call it x. And then you write your continuity equation between the two, you see, rho of q. It's actually even easier than fluid equation, the way we are doing it, the x. And then what you are doing is that you are now writing the Jacobian here, because you know I'm putting this rho of x, rho of q, very simple mathematics. So here you've got a determinant of dq by dx, right? And so if I could, I know x, because this is just given positions here. And I've got rho of x. Rho of q, I know is uniform. And all I have to do is the correspondence between q and x. And then from there, I can find the velocities. It's quite simple, actually. Theoretically, it's quite simple. And
But the challenge, of course, is that you don't actually measure rho of x. You're counting galaxies.
Oh, I'm not. Yeah, here I'm not counting. But I'm coming to that. You're ahead of me. I'm not counting yet. I am using the luminosity to find a mass, yes. But it would be much nicer if I could count and I could forget about the luminosities, yes. And that's what we are going to do. So it would be nice, you know. Here I need to know the mass of each object, and that's what we have been discussing. You know, you have got luminosity. First of all, you don't know how much the luminosity is. Second of all, you don't know what is the relationship between luminosity and mass, so you have to assume a bias and so on. And all of that are just not very nice, straightforward, so there's a lot of modeling in it. So first of all, this was a lot of dispute, and I got fed up with all the dispute. You know, people would come and contradict themselves, and this is still going on. You see, there was a recent paper, I can show you if I still have it, just to show you as how far these discussions are lingering. You see, this is like a plot from 60F, it's recent, it's relatively recent, 2016. So you see that, right? And So there are some people who have their plot, their point was like here, these are different groups. And this is what lambda CDM is basically saying, and these are just the sigma lines. And you see these, there are groups that were higher up, there are people who were higher down, and then very recently, you know, there was even a point here. So I thought that, you know, would it not be really nice?
W09 is my Hartzell's paper.
Yes, but then I didn't put his recent, his 2 years one that okay. It came down. I don't know if Mike is here, but I was thinking of Mike when I said some people contradicted themselves.
Mike is not here.
Okay, good. So we can just say things like that. So would it not be very nice, you know, if you could just go really much higher, where then there would not be a question of disputing, you know, people would say, well, we converge it, but, you know, then lambda CDM is, you know, this is 2 sigma and so on. But it would go really, really, very, very high redshift, large distances, and then really establish this, whether the universe is isotopic or not. Because there at very large distances, lambda CDM is definitely saying that the universe is isotropic. And we definitely need to approach CMB dipole at those large scales. So if I go to very large scales, basically to the edge of the universe, where I actually see the CMB more or less, you know, I'm not far from CMB. And if there I actually see that my data points are here or here and are not here, then I know that it's not 1 or 2 sigma. And that would be quite nice. And then it would also be nice if I didn't have to worry about the mass and things. But how could I do that? You know, if I go to very large distances, I don't have any galaxies. I can't observe any things. There I have sources that are not in the visible band. I have radio sources, I have quasars, but I don't really have galaxies. But I have many radio sources and quasars. These are very luminous objects, not in the visible band, but in radio bands, and quasars like in infrared bands. So I have many of these objects at high redshift, but the problem is that I don't know at which distances they are. I know that these very luminous objects are mostly at high distances, but then they could also be nearby. So I have loads of them. Instead of like a few hundred thousand, I have millions and millions of these. But then I only know their angular position on the sky. I only know their projected position on the sky around me. What can I do with that information? How can I use just the projected position of sources on the sky and talk about isotropy, which is a 3D question, right? I mean, I can't just say, oh, well, look at them. They are isotropically distributed on, above me. But then, you see, I don't know where they are, actually. So I need the 3D informations. Naively, I need 3D informations. But it happens that one of the oldest methods in astronomy can help us. And people have actually been using just these two informations to talk about the velocity, our velocity, which is what we are looking for. And this takes us back a little about 1700 to the time of Bradley, basically to the aberration of light. So what is aberration of light? Just a little bit of history. So for those of you who are falling asleep, so you wake up. And when Copernicus talked about his model of the universe, his heliocentric model, many astronomers were trying to falsify it. And many others who believed in him were trying to verify it. And then they thought, well, how could we say that? You know, how could we verify a Copernicus principle that, you know, the universe is heliocentric and the Earth is not the center of the universe? And then what they were thinking about was parallax. They were saying, okay, parallax, if the Earth is moving around the Sun in January and in June, Earth is going to be at two different positions because Copernicus is saying that it's moving around the Sun. And so if I look at a fixed star in the sky in January, its position should be different from when I look at it in, let's say, June, because the Earth has moved. I mean, parallax is very simple. You just stick your fingers in front of your eyes, and you close one eye, and you close another eye, and your finger will move. And parallax depends on distance. The nearer this finger is to your eyes, the amount that it moves is larger. And then you see, Copernicus is about 1500, and this is 1700. You see, this is still going on for 200 years. I mean, it's the same, the same problem as we have with the CMB dipole. It's just a dispute going on, and people are saying, well, it's, you know, I have found the parallax. Even Hooke, who was a great, very respected person, said at some point that he discovered the parallax. And then you see 200 years passed, and Bradley came, who was a very meticulous astronomer, and he decided really to make very long and meticulous observations of a star, fixed star, I think it was Draconis or something, in the sky. And he went on and on and on. And what he realized was that the position of the star moved, but it didn't seem to depend on on our position. It depended more or less on the velocity, on our velocity. And that is when he discovered, actually, the aberration, because aberration is basically the change in the position of the sources, which depends on the velocity of the observer, not on the position. And in doing that, he actually made, not only he discovered aberration, but he also made the most important and accurate measurements of the velocity of light. Don't forget, at that time, they thought the light had an infinite velocity. And he actually made the measurement of the velocity of light, which was very, very accurate. And so this is basically aberration. When you are moving, you see, you're in a rain, and then you have to just bend your umbrella. You know it very well here, because you have a lot of rain here, I suppose. And then you see, the physics is that, so you are an observer, you have a motion, and you know, it's in a, if you are looking at the source in a rest frame, it's in a position, and in another moving frame, in another position. Now look at that. These formulas are completely classical. There is no special relativity in them. Of course, this is a special relativistic effect, but the formula of Bradley was quite accurate, actually. And if you're moving, not only there is aberration, but there is also a second effect that, you know, the sources that you could not move, you could not see before, not you could see, but this is a different thing. Now, the question is, so, what Bradley was doing was just looking at the position of a single star. But what we are talking about is cosmology, universe with loads of sources and things. So what the Bradley's discovery of aberration got to do with what we want to do. We also want to find our velocity at the end of the day. We want to see what it is, our velocity, whether it's the velocity that gives the CMB dipole or not. But then I'm not just looking at one star. I'm looking at I want to know what is my velocity with respect to distant sources. And that brings us to the work of George Ellis in 1984, many hundred years after Bradley, that you see, George Ellis made the prediction that if the universe is anisotropic on a larger scale, then the observer has a velocity. If it has a velocity, by looking at the aberration effect, the effect physics is exactly the same, and then the effect. And a second effect that the sources you could not see, now you would see because they become magnified if you're moving. Then he wrote the dipole formula, basically, using completely a special relativistic treatment that, you know, the velocity observer is related to the dipole. Now, what is this dipole? It's basically dipole in the number count. So you're not looking at the flux. You could, but you're not. You're using that. You're using the properties of the flux and so on. But you're not using the flux. You don't need the bias. You don't need the mass to light and things. And so the velocity is related to the dipole in the number count. And dipole in the number count basically means that in the direction of the motion, you will be measuring, you will be seeing more sources than behind you. So if your universe is completely isotropic, if you're at rest, you're seeing the same number count all around you. But if you have a motion, and you measure it on different angles around you, you'll see more in front than behind. And this is what we have done. It's extremely powerful. It's powerful because it's independent of distance. So it doesn't matter where your source is. I don't need to know the distances. I can use this test. And actually, Ellis and Baldwin in their paper, they say it quite nicely. So they say that, let me read it for you. They say, thus, existence of such an observed anisotropy is a test of the isotropy of the source counts in their rest frame. Now, this is really true. The great power of this test is that the measurements can be made and the result must hold for any source count, whether in a wide or a narrow solid angle, for flat or steep source spectra, etc., respective of the selection effects or source evolution, as long as the forward and backward measurements are done in the identical manner. So it's extremely powerful. I don't need redshift, I don't need distances, as long as when I observe in one direction, I don't have any bias, you know, I don't suddenly decide I want to look more in that direction. And that, yes?
This is assuming that the rest prime of the CMB is the same as the rest prime of the galaxies.
Assuming and testing that, because if the rest frame of CMB is not the same as the rest frame of the galaxies, then I can find out. Because if it is at the same, then the velocity that I find would be the same, right? And if I find a different velocity, that means the rest frame of CMB is not the same rest frame of the galaxy. That's exactly this what this test would establish. Yes, yes.
The low redshift galaxies act like a contamination for your data set.
The
low redshift.
Yes, exactly, yes. Definitely, because at low redshift, you know that they are clustered, you see? Because as I showed you, at low redshift, you have got more. So if you're just going to count the number of galaxies, and you're including the rotless shift, then of course you're going to measure more there. But this is not a proof of the anisotropy of the universe. This is just local anisotropy. So what you need to do, you need to make sure that you don't have any local contamination. And that is...
You need to have an idea of where is local and where is beyond local.
Exactly. And this can help us, you see. What we have done so far can help us. These things can help us because this is local now. Because now we have really sort of flew away because this is quite local. And we know that locally we can sort of have an idea how much velocity these sources would give us. See? But there is no real term, there is no real parameter that would say that, you know, you're local and, you know, we don't have any control parameter here to say where we are local and now we are going away. So it's going to be gradual. But we have an idea, we have a good idea because we know our local universe quite well. Better than the global universe.
Also, gradually.
I should. This is going fast now because now we are basically applying. Now also, when you are looking at the radio sources, they are mostly at high redshifts. That you know, these luminous sources are very high redshift. So then, see, the rest of this talk is that application of Ellison-Baldwin test. It's the first thing that we applied it to was the radio data. So we had about, you see this catalog that we got is quite a nice catalog, MVSS catalog. We had about 1 million, almost 2 million sources, but you can't use all of them. So you have to clean up, get rid of the galactic plane, do a flux cut and so on. And at the end of the day, you are left with about 500,000. And then you see one of the other things that we did, sort of less interesting, so we patched it, making sure that, you know, they're compatible with another data set. And so you see, we have got a full sky now, just with the galactic plane missing. And then you see here is a measurement using Ellison-Baldwin test of the dipole. And all the blue dots that you see are the hemispheres. These are basically showing you the directions on the celestial sphere that has got more galaxies than the mean, and these have got less galaxies than the mean. You see a sort of a dipolar pattern immediately. I'm not fitting anything here. This is just the data telling you. And this is also the data, you see. There is no fitting here. The magenta is fitting, the dipole, but the data already is telling you that there is a cosine tendency in the number count. This is a number count. So this is a number count of the radio sources. This is the direction of the CMB. It's in this direction. And this is the direction of the matter dipole, or the dipole of the radio sources. And so they're very close, but the amplitude is twice as large. See, this is much larger than CMB dipole. This is where I'm showing you the velocities here. So this goes about twice larger than the CMB dipole. Now, the problem is that the statistical significance of this is very low. It's about less than 3 sigma. Why is it low? First of all, because I don't have enough sources. I have about 500,000. It's a ground base, there are systematics, and so on. So would it not be nice to increase the statistical significance? Yes, it would be very nice. So it happens that we have got another data. Now, I'm completely different data set. These are also very quasars. They are very powerful, very luminous. But this data is coming from space. the other data was a ground-based. So this is infrared. These are infrared sources. These are normal radio sources. And this is a VICE catalog. So this is a VICE satellite that scanned the whole universe, basically. And it has scanned 700 million sources. It's huge. But all of them are not useful for us because there are asteroids, there are this and that, and then there's a lot of contamination. So after we cleaned it up, we had a catalog of about 1.5 million quasars. And you see, this is just a density field, just a smooth. I'm not doing anything. I've just got a simple smoothing. And you see there is already some sort of a dipole structure in it. So now if we really go and measure it, we can measure it. We also have a redshift distribution. They don't give us the redshift, but you can cross-correlate it with other data like BAS and SDSS, and you get some redshift distribution. So this is answer to your question. Most of these sources are at high redshift. You see, these are mostly at redshift around 1. So at small redshift, there are very few sources. So these are high redshift. They are very minor contamination at low redshift. This is the nature of the flux. So these are power laws, basically. These are what is more or less expected. And now we want to see what is the significance of this data, what is the dipole that we can measure, what is the significance. Now, we do a null hypothesis test, which is very usual. And so you say that if I have an observer, so what you do is you make mock catalogs of the data, and you say, OK, if I've got an observer that is moving with the velocity that I expect from the CMB, which is about 400 kilometers per second, what is the chance that I would see the dipole that I see in this data, the number count dipole that I see? And this is the rejection of the null hypothesis. So you see that this is what I'm showing you. The histogram here has got about 10 million simulations, basically 10 million mock catalogs that resemble in all aspects the VICE data. And this is the CMB dipole, basically, here. You see? Basically, the observer that is moving the velocity inferred from CMB dipole would see in the data. And this is what I get from the quasar data. So this is basically, if you like, the CMB rest frame. And this is the matter rest frame. Very different.
Sorry, but then you were really worried about the luminosity reconstruction. Because if you have a misreconstruction, then some objects will enter or exit your data set, right? Because if something is like randomly brighter because your detector did some error or something, then that will enter your data set and that will lead to a problem, right? So how do you account for that?
Yes, I mean, you have to be, there is always that when you have got a flux limited catalog. Now, what you have to consider is that there are 1.5 million sources, but the sources that are making this dipole are the ones that are really at the flux limit.
Exactly, so that's where.
So as long as you, yeah, sure. But as long as your sensitivity to flux is the same everywhere, then that's fine.
But then I worry about that because these detectors, for instance, I know, I don't know about the radio, but the infrared detectors, what I know they do, they look somewhere and then they have in their, like, whatever pixelated array that they have, they subtract the background flux. So they look, they subtract background flux because these detectors have dark counts, so they need to subtract that. So as they move, I will worry that they are subtracting a number that is a bit different.
But if they're doing that everywhere, then that's what the Ellis and Baldwin test is very powerful. If they are doing the same mistake everywhere, then it's fine in some sense. Not fine, fine, but it's fine.
I think Dustin made this, didn't you? Dustin, didn't you discuss a lot?
Oh, you used the catalog.
Okay. Let me ask you differently. For instance, this is WISE, right?
So, yes.
And you're looking at AGNs at infrared. Is there data from Spitzer or JWST about those AGNs that allows you to see the luminosity of that one? I measure it. It's a Spitzer or JWST that have a better sensitivity. And then I correlate with WISE, and then I see all my luminosity in JWST is the same than the one that I measure in WISE. And I do it around.
That could be a test of that, yes. I don't know if anyone has done it. Okay. See, when we got that, JWST was not yet really.
Yes, Spitzer probably has much better sensitivity.
Yes, 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 right. Yes. What I really want to say is that it's probable that all these systematics. Now, the most important systematic here is the scanning pattern of WISE, which we took care of. Right. Ecliptic, yeah, because it's got it goes on the ecliptic poles. And so that we have taken care of. And that's the most, but of course, there are all these other systematics. Okay. Yeah.
Would you mind talking about how you do that?
Well, it's simple, actually. You don't want, in some sense, you're removing any variation that is sort of correlated with a scanning pattern on the ecliptic pole. Yeah, it's not, yeah. But then you know that the dipole is not in that direction anyway, so yes. But you could be missing some signal. I agree with that, yeah. But the scanning pattern of WISE was our major systematic that we have, yes.
100 times more exposure.
Yes, definitely. Now, if I translate this to the sigma, you see, I see that this is about 5 sigma. Now, I want to go back now to the radio data, if I have got I don't know. Yeah, let me just go 1 minute. So now I've shown you radio data. I've shown you WISE data. Are they consistent? We went back to the radio data using sort of our knowledge of all the systematics and so on. And we looked at them again. And so you see, this is quite important because there is very little overlap between the two. So these are two completely independent catalogs. They have very different systematics. One is ground-based, one is a space-based. One has got radio sources that are evolved. They are basically dead. The other ones are just, we are basically looking at the accretion disk. They're very gas-rich disks. So they are very, very different sources. The frequencies are 2 orders of magnitude difference between the two. And the results, so we analyzed them, basically, the two catalogs. We removed those sources from WISE that are in NBSS. There are a few thousand sources. We've removed them all. Completely independent catalogs, orthogonal catalogs, basically. And now, are we getting the same result? Well, we are getting the same result. And you see the significance of NBSS, of course, is lower. Now I'm showing you a significance plot, which is 2D. So this is really as bad as it can get, basically, or as good as it can get for isotropy. But this is the most pessimistic approach. So I'm getting about less than 3 sigma for NBSS. Of course, that is what we had before, because we don't have so many sources. And here I'm about 4 sigma. And if you combine them using proper combination of independent data, you get something about 5 sigma. Now, our data were made public at the time, and many people used them. And they have used different methods. So recently, people have used Bayesian approach to the data, and they've got even higher significance. So group of Lawrence Dam and so on, they've got more than 5 sigma. And group of Dominic Schwartz and so on, they've reused the radio data, and they've got more than 4 sigma using Bayesian approach. And so what is the conclusion? Well, I don't want to make the conclusion. Actually, George Ellis already wrote it in the paper. So he basically said that if the standard of rest determined by the MBR, at that time they would say MBR, microwave background radiation, but this is basically CMB, and the number counts were to be in serious disagreement, which is what we have now. So what can we conclude? One would have to abandon either. One, the idea that the radio sources are at cosmological distances. Now, we are not going to abandon that. I see at that time they didn't know. But I don't think anyone wants to say that they are not at cosmological distances. B, the interpretation of the cosmic microwave background radiation as relic radiation from the Big Bang. That's even worse. We don't want to say it's not relic radiation. And the third one is the standard FRLW universe model just need to be abandoned. So I leave you to choose, but I want to show you the one last transparency, which is very nice, from Jim Peebles in an essay in Annals of Physics in 2022. So he's basically saying that, and this is my conclusion, that the lambda CDM cosmology passes demanding tests that establish it as a good approximation to reality. And I fully agree with that. It really passes a lot of tests, many tests, across different data, different systematics, different modeling, and so on. The theory is incomplete, of course, and open issues are being examined in active research programs. Now, he talks then about the dipole anisotropy, and he says, the dipole anisotropy in the distribution of objects at distances comparable to the Hubble lengths is about in the direction expected from the kinematic effect if the dipole anisotropy in the CMB is due to our motion relative to the rest frame defined by the mean mass distribution. But the dipole amplitude is at least twice the prediction. This anomaly is about as well established as the Hubble tension. Yet the literature on the kinematic effect is much smaller than the 344 papers. Nowadays it's 3,000, because this is like, with the phrase Hubble tension in the abstract in the NASA data system. I expect the difference is an inevitable consequence of the way we behave. But thanks very much. Sorry about going wrong.
Any other questions?
Just referring to the paper that you showed by Alice, so the earlier one, so you were suggesting that we might have to change the FLRW model. So does he give, or do you have any suggestions for how we could change it? Is there a, like an effective model that you could FRW base with? Like, I know Alice was working also on back reaction, right? Is that something that...
Yeah, he worked on lots of things, yeah. He's where, he's the, yeah, he's a GR, he's, yeah. Well, I'm not going to say anything because you are theorist here, so I wouldn't dare saying, you know, to theorists what they should, what theory. I wish that you would tell me, you know. That is why I was very excited to give a talk here, because you're a theorist, and now we need you. And we need you to tell us, you know, is there a model that could fit this, but at the same time, you know, be agree with all the other data that are fit quite well by Lambda CDM. And this is exactly what Jim Peebles is saying. Lambda CDM is great, but it's incomplete. So for sure, there is a model that, you know, is, works better and can, you know, solve many tensions that are arising and are coming up. But I don't have really any anything. I'm definitely not in front of theorists.
I ask a question.
Salim first, and then one more question, and then you, John.
So comment on the Hubble tension. You know, maybe what was it? 30% of people kind of suspect that the Hubble tension might be systematic. So, like, you know, maybe it's not always like healthy to like immediately do that analogy on the count. So on that level, actually, so you don't include the effect on the anisotropic effect and the flux cut limited surveys, as far as I understand from. Like for example, like the lensing analogy, you'd have magnification bias, and so basically the flux that you measure would be affected by lensing in multiple ways. One is the one that you also described, that is that, you know, like it's essentially the number counts changes as the magnification changes, but also there's another effect, you know, that the overall so the overall luminosity also changes anyway. So like, for example, could that mimic? So that's like a percent effect anyways. Could that mimic some dipole like tension? So this is like much more than that.
So this is like, if I understand you correctly, this is basically what we call Doppler boosting effect.
Yeah,
so that is taken into account, you see. The Doppler boosting is taken into account.
Yes, okay.
The Doppler boosting is taken into account. Now people have also looked at lensing after us and they said, well, the effect is very small.
Yeah.
But the two effects are two effects, aberration and Doppler boosting. Yeah, exactly. And that we have taken into account, and it is taken into account in the formula of Ellison-Baldwin. So you see, there are two indices, alpha and x, because you have got and this is, you see, this is the Doppler boosting. I think that you're referring to. You know, the thing is, those as you could not see, they would shift up, and the frequency would move because they are Doppler boosted. And so, yeah, that's definitely taken into account.
Gaia also has a quasar
cutoff. Yes. So Gaia has unwise, but it's in the blue band apparently. And then there you see the systematics are slightly different. Yeah, we did actually start looking at Gaia unwise, and I think some people have looked at that definitely and written paper. But the result is agreed. Actually, they found the same thing. Yeah. But definitely with the new versions of Gaia, that's definitely worthwhile looking into.
John, you had a question?
Yes. So I just wanted to make a comment question. We're kept the maximally symmetric Lambda CDM model is potentially facing two tensions. One is the Hubble constant tension, and the other is your cosmic low CMB dipole. So we can probably fit in the dipole issue with the Bianchi type model. And maybe homogeneous but anisotropic. However, we also have to fit in the, we had to consider the Hubble tension. So the question is, if we give up FRW, maximally symmetric unique model, how far do we have to deviate from lambda CDM to fit in these two issues, these two tensions?
Yes, I cannot talk for Hubble tension really, but for this one, you see, this is a 10 to the minus 2 effect. And so it is an effect at more than 5 sigma now. Even the recent results with Bayesian, it's, if you consider all of them, it's now at even 6 sigma. But it's not a big effect. That's why you see this has been going on for a long time, and it's just now that all these data have come that could establish it. And what lambda CDM is saying, basically the CMB dipole, that the, so it's twice larger than what is predicted by lambda, basically lambda CDM. And yes, I haven't looked at the Bianchi model, but of course that's the first thing that comes to mind. And if I understood correctly, they have not all been ruled out by CMB. So,
but there's a paper by on the archive this past July.
Yes,
by Krishnan Montal and Sheikh Jabari, and yes, they claim to fit. They claim to be able to.
That's right.
Deal with the dipole.
Yes.
Bianchi 5. But whether they could pull all the lambda CM data, particularly CMB data, is not clear.
Yes, I know of that paper, not very well, but they are building model based on FLRW, right? Although they talk about Bianchi, if I don't make a mistake, yeah. I think it's. They are looking at tilted universe.
Maybe one more quick question here.
Yeah, some people trying to extract the dipole from the gravitational wave state.
Yes, yes, yes. There have been papers on that. Yeah. Basically predicting that you can do the same thing you can do with gravitational waves, yes. But I think they need to wait. I mean, that's what they said. For future data, yes. Yes.
20 yes. Centimeter as well.
Huh?
20 centimeter and intensity.
Yes, yes, you can do that with those. I mean, basically any data that traces the universe at larger scales and there's no special bias that, you know, in one, you would have a, they don't have intrinsic dipole in them, can be used to establish this. But for me, there could still be systematics, but I think this is more or less established. Now the question for me, the good question would be, what is it? And you know, what is the model that would explain this? And whether that model could explain other data also.
Okay, since we are running quite a bit, I have a few announcements. One is that Voya is also giving a colloquium at Applied Math Department, University of Waterloo, on Thursday, 2:30, on using optic.
Yes, I'm talking about this stuff.
Physical data?
Yes.
Yes, there is.
Optimal transport, yeah. Yes.
And we will be having dinner tonight with her at 6 o'clock in the bistro. And last but not least, she's going to be here most of the week. Her office is 353.
Yes.
So if you want to chat with her and ask more questions, please do so. With that, thanks again.
Thank you very much. Yeah, thanks. Thank you.